June is here, which means it's finally time to reach for your summer wardrobe. And if you're trying to look good without overheating, Quince is your best bet. Their summer collection has all the warm weather staples, breathable linen, washable silk, and soft organic cotton. I now own their 100% linen pants in more colors than I'd like to admit. And the best part is that you get all that quality without the luxury markup. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a destination for elevated essentials across the home, from kitchen to bedding, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into everyday life. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/campus for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/campus for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/campus.
Kept telling her how I was insecure financially. She said, "You're not going to have to worry. Trust me." She said, "You just have to accept." I told her how it was advertised to me as number one. She said that that was the lie on the website and that almost all the students are let in.
That's Evan. You heard from him a few weeks ago when he shared his experience with USC's online social work program. What Evan and his classmates didn't know at the time was that the program wasn't actually being run by USC. It was being run by a for-profit company called 2U. As we were doing research for that episode, it became clear that Evan's story was just one part of a much larger issue, for-profit education. It's a topic that we wanted to take a closer look at.
These schools, they're notorious. Federal legislators have known about these shady behaviors for decades. Decades.
For over 30 years, a network of colleges and universities has preyed on America's most vulnerable students, luring them into taking out loans that they'll likely never be able to repay.
Anytime you have a program that's the size of the federal student aid program, it's going to attract people who see it as a way to make money.
While these schools rake in billions of dollars, it's the students who are left saddled with debt.
And so I put together this very extensive Google form, and we got just under 500 borrowers to fill it out, and we were collectively $70 million in debt.
Normally on Campus Files, we bring you a new story every week, but this topic is too big to cover in just one episode. So over the next few weeks, we're bringing you a three-part story about for-profit colleges and universities in America. The series will be written and narrated by my colleague, Ian Mont.
I'm Ian Mont. This week on Campus Files, For-Profit, Part 1, The Pain Funnel. This story begins outside the classroom, in the fantasy world of a video game.
Long ago, a lone sorcerer saved the last of his kind from an unstoppable invasion.
Asheron's Call was kind of like a knights and portals and wizardry and spells and archery game.
The Empyrean left this world to a race of insects, the Ulthoi.
Like, I had a character that was good with swords and a bow. He went on these little adventures, and it was pretty fun.
That's Mike DiGiacomo. Back in 2002, he was a supply and logistics specialist for the U.S. Army, stationed in Alaska. By day, he jumped out of planes and tracked equipment. But off-duty, his world revolved around a video game called Asheron's Call.
It was actually referred to me by some people that played from the barracks. It was very popular amongst the other soldiers that were playing. They always updated it, and everybody would rush to try to complete the update to see who could do stuff first, or just like hang out with friends, or, you know, it was a community thing, so it was fun.
When Mike's time in the military was up, he was ready to leave his job, but not Asheron's Call. He was so hooked on the game that he actually set his sights on working for the company that produced it. But there was just one problem. The military, of course, does not train its soldiers on animation or game development. So when Mike left the Army in 2002, He had a pretty good sense of what he wanted to do next. He wanted to be on the team that made Acheron's Call.
It was owned by Microsoft, but ran by a company called Turbine, which was in Westwood, Mass at the time.
Mike grew up in Massachusetts, just outside Boston, practically next door to the offices of Turbine, the developers behind Acheron's Call.
It was actually made near my house, not even probably 2 miles from my house. So it was kind of like one of those like full circle things. And I was like, oh, well, that'd be cool.
It felt like it was meant to be, especially because Mike had attended a specialized vocational high school and already had digital art skills at a time when computer skills were relatively rare. But there was a hiccup. Turbine only considered applicants with an undergraduate degree and a portfolio of animation work.
And now, here are three good reasons why you should get off the couch and call GIFT. Number one, they'll send you a free brochure about programs in graphic design, web design, animation, and multimedia.
So my mom had seen the commercial for Gibbs College, or Catherine Gibbs as they called it, and she said that they had an animation program based on the commercials there.
Doing this can open a door to the kind of future that you've always wanted.
I was like, okay, well, that's cool. Let me look into it, because as far as I know, I was the first from my family to go to college.
Mike learned that Gibbs College had been teaching graphic design for a while, and they had just introduced a brand new animation program, perfect for Mike. The icing on the cake was the location, Newbury Street, right in the heart of Boston's swanky Back Bay neighborhood. So Mike went in for an admissions interview. He was ready. He knew exactly what to look for and the right questions to ask.
I tell him, basically, I'm looking to end up working in 3D animation designing for Turbine. You know, I use them as an example. And they said, oh yeah, we have job placement there.
It felt almost too good to be true. An animation program right near his hometown, plus job placement at his dream company. So when the interviewer told Mike they thought he'd be a good fit, he was over the moon. There was just one thing left to figure out, the cost. So he asked the interviewer.
Financial aid said, you know, we have financial aid through Sallie Mae, our preferred federal lender, which seemed to be a term used a lot back then.
Sallie Mae, short for the Student Loan Marketing Association, was initially a government entity created to act as a middleman for federal student loans. But right around the time Mike was starting school, they cut ties with the federal government and began offering private loans. The problem with that is that many people still associated Sallie Mae with federal aid. Few knew about the shift or the fact that these private loans had far fewer protections and a much higher interest rate. Mike didn't know any of this when he was applying. And why would he? Almost nobody pays attention to the fine print of student loans. Plus, Mike had the friendly staff in the financial aid office to walk him through it.
Well, how much is this going to cost or whatever? And go, oh, no, we have financial aid and it'll only be like $100 to $200 a month for financial aid once you're done.
It was no small monthly bill, but if Mike got a job at Turbine or got his foot in the door in the industry, it would be worth it. Plus, as a veteran, Mike had extra GI Bill funding, which could help pay for school without requiring him to take out as many loans. So after some reflection, Mike made the decision to sign up. He registered for classes and stopped by the financial aid office to get set up with support. He signed a simple promissory note, basically just a legal document agreeing to pay back money in the future. And just like that, he was set up for aid from Sallie Mae. Mike started his first semester, but almost immediately something felt off.
You know, you're doing the basic classes, like it kind of felt to me a little bit like I was starting at the bottom again. And I'm noticing a lot of the people that are in there with me are not as experienced or not even focused, so to speak. I remember there was one kid, he would bring stuff to school to sell, like electronics or auto parts, which was wacky.
Beyond the subpar classes and beginner level students, yet another red flag appeared. Toward the end of his first semester, Mike was abruptly pulled out of class.
So basically, they would go to you when you're in class, they would pull you out of class and say, hey, you need to sign up for this, you need to fill out, you know, apply to Sallie Mae, or you can't go back to class.
The paperwork was yet another promissory note, like the one he'd signed when he first started at Gibbs. The note, he was told, was just to finalize his financial paperwork for the next semester. Getting pulled out of class felt a bit strange, but he wasn't the only one. Other students were being called out too. So he didn't overthink it. His focus was on classwork.
When I did work hard, I think I hit the honor roll a couple times.
But by the halfway point, Mike still hadn't started any 3D design classes. And after meeting with the department chair, he learned he'd been assigned the wrong class days. The animation professors taught on Tuesdays and Thursdays. He'd been assigned Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It was a pretty big oversight, given how clear he was about wanting to do animation in his admissions interview. But eventually it was taken care of, and he was placed in the right courses. Unfortunately, the animation courses were no better.
When the teachers were going over lessons, it just seemed like they were reading from a book, or they had no idea what they were talking about.
What's more, it didn't seem like they were setting him up for success in the workforce.
The program chair and people in there were pushing you towards doing a print portfolio. And I had heard, you know, for animation wise, they'd want you to have like a demo reel. I think I got in an argument with the program chair a couple times about it.
Mike was still trying to sort out the demo reel by the time he reached the end of his curriculum. At this point, Gibbs required an internship as a way to get real on-the-ground experience.
The internship teacher, he was all about like, yeah, we're going to get you a paid internship at a TV studio, which sounded incredible to me. Well, come to find out, when I showed up, it was a wedding videographer. And he said, oh yeah, and I have this equipment in the truck. Help me unload the truck. So I'm going around doing, you know, these errands for him, and he's nowhere around me. I'm just doing errands. I get back, and I guess he had gone mountain biking with his girlfriend at the time or something. And then the equipment, I know it was basically just cardboard boxes. There was laundry in them. So I was moving around his laundry.
At this point, Mike was pretty fed up with Gibbs. He'd been placed in the wrong courses, his internship was a farce. When he asked for the promised help making a demo reel, he was told to do it on his own time. When he inquired about job placement support, they suggested he apply at Staples. And to top it all off, when it came time for graduation, he was told his degree was in graphic design, not animation.
I remember towards the end there, I was actually working in a supermarket. When I found out it was going to be graphic design, I skipped the graduation and mopped floors.
Mike had walked away with a diploma, but no real skills in animation, no industry connections, and no clear path to his dream job. None of what he was directly promised. But soon, an unexpected opportunity would come along and change everything. Mike DiGiacomo graduated from Gibbs in 2005. He was disillusioned by the whole experience, but he figured he had just been dealt a bad hand.
I felt like that was an isolated school, like it was just one bad school I picked.
So when a friend mentioned another school that might be a better fit, Mike was intrigued. The school was called the New England Institute of Art.
The name alone sounded prestigious because it kind of borrowed from mass art, which was prestigious, which I had originally looked into.
So Mike gave it another shot. He reached out to the Art Institute and landed an admissions interview. Right from the start, the school felt much more professional than Gibbs.
I got called in and it walked through like a gallery that they had like student work. I think there was success stories on the wall as well.
And the more he learned about the program, the more it stood apart from Gibbs.
Speaking with the representative, I had asked, you know, about the animation program. He had told me, hey, the program director there actually invented the way hair works in animation, you know, invented that technology.
Finally, some real animation credentials. But Mike was still on guard after his experience at Gibbs.
I was nervous about the job placement situation. Because of my experience at Gibbs, you know, I wanted to make sure I was good to go. When I said my goal, which was working for Turbine, he said, oh yeah, not only do we have job placement at Turbine, we have job placement at Pixar, you know, and many other companies like that.
Another reassuring difference was the interview itself. Looking back, the Gibbs admissions officers had almost felt too eager, too accommodating, almost like they'd take anyone. But this interview was tough, and while Mike doesn't remember the exact admissions numbers they cited, he does remember they told him it was highly competitive.
When I heard I was accepted, I was over the moon and happy. Like, oh, I'm going to be able to turn my bad experience into an even better one. It was like a huge campus. It felt college-y, if that makes any sense. Gibbs felt like an office building that they just kind of moved into.
But once he got inside the classroom, it turned out the schools had more in common than he expected.
You know, you're in classes like this is supposed to be a hard to get into program. And you're in with people that could barely draw like a face. There was one class that was like supposed to be like the history of multimedia or something like that, I think it was. And it turned out to be a guy talking about his DVD collection. It didn't feel like a college class. It didn't feel like I was learning anything in that class.
And once again, Mike found himself being pulled out of class to sign yet more promissory notes, authorizing the school to take out more loans in his name. It felt strange, just like it had at Gibbs. But he had no frame of reference. None of his family members had gone to college. Maybe this is just how it works. He might have kept believing that, if not for one professor.
I was taking a digital multimedia class, and I remember I really liked that class because the teacher was a really nice guy. But when he came into the class that day, he told us, "You realize you're paying as much to go here as people pay to go to Harvard. And I hope you're getting your money's worth." What he said weighed with me because he was actually an adjunct teacher who had also been teaching at Harvard. So I took that as a major red flag.
Up until this point, Mike had no real sense how much he owed for Gibbs or the Art Institute. Sure, he knew he'd have loans to pay off, but the financial aid offices had always reassured him that there was nothing to worry about. The idea that his debt could rival the cost of a Harvard education had never even crossed his mind. But soon, he was about to find out just how deep into debt he'd sunk. Mike withdrew from the Art Institute in 2006, and soon after, his first student loan bills arrived. And with them, a sinking realization. He'd been lied to. We'll hear more from Mike later in this episode, but first we're going to take a step back, because Mike's story isn't unique. Every year, thousands of students find themselves trapped in a cycle of debt, paying off loans for schools that promised prosperity and opportunity, but delivered subpar education and a lifelong financial burden. So how did we get here? What exactly is a for-profit school? Where did they come from, and how did this industry grow into a multi-billion dollar machine? Let's start by defining what for-profit schools even are and why that distinction matters. Stick with me for a second because we have to talk about legal responsibility, which I promise is a key part of this story. In the US, there are generally three types of schools. First, we have public state schools. Across the 8 and 1/4. Take the University of California system, for example.
Is Berkeley, home of the University of California. One of the largest and finest universities in the country.
The UC system is legally accountable to the people of California. Its primary job is to provide an education as a public service. The second type is a nonprofit school. Take NYU or MIT, for example.
At the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, perforated tape introduces the data.
Nonprofits are legally responsible for addressing a specific social cause. All money taken in is reinvested into the organization, all to serve the nonprofit's mission, which in this case is education. Finally, there are for-profit schools.
Ever think you could be part of this? With the right training, you can. Not an artist, it doesn't matter.
Unlike the other two cases, for-profit schools have owners that they exist exclusively to serve. This could be a wealthy family, an investment company, or shareholders on the stock exchange. This distinction of responsibility and ownership is key. While state and nonprofit schools must, of course, remain financially stable and they set their tuition accordingly, their primary purpose is to serve a public good, not to make money. every major and minor decision they make should be guided by what is best for the educational mission. A for-profit school, on the other hand, has the opposite responsibility. Their only legal obligation is to generate as much money as possible for their owners, and to make more and more money every year. Every major and minor decision they make is driven by profit. Education is secondary.
They have a pressure constantly from investors to report higher earnings, and that gives them a pressure to enroll as many students as they can. So that is bad for students when someone has to keep going to Wall Street every quarter and explaining profits are up, profits are down. It makes them want desperately to bring in new students.
This is David Halperin. He spent most of his career in Washington, holding impressive positions like Special Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs or Presidential Speechwriter for Bill Clinton. He's become an expert on for-profit colleges.
Not much money is spent on education. A lot of the money goes to advertising and recruiting, quite a bit, to paying for TV ads, to paying for internet ads, to paying third-party lead generators, to hire armies of recruiters, to hire lawyers to get them out of trouble when they get in trouble for recruiting, and lobbyists to try to prevent more strict rules that would make it harder to recruit.
David first encountered the problem of for-profit schools sometime around 2009, just after Mike decided to leave the Art Institute. At that time, David was at the Center for American Progress, a think tank in DC.
Around the beginning of the Obama administration in 2009 and 10, I started to learn about the issue of for-profit higher education.
And what immediately stood out to David was just how massive, yet mostly invisible, this industry was.
But what I learned was that this industry had gone crazy. It was getting about 10% of all U.S. college students, 25% of all the federal financial aid, which amounted to $30 billion a year.
The for-profit education industry wasn't always this big. It's basically been around since federal funding for education was introduced in 1965. But there were always legal guardrails in place to limit the potential for profit. That was until the George W. Bush administration, when lobbyists made major strides in rolling back regulations.
They had spent the George W. Bush years convincing Congress to relax the rules that were supposed to protect students against for-profit predatory education. The for-profit college industry ran wild in the 2000s. So at its peak, the for-profit college industry was getting $30 billion a year from the Department of Education grants and loans, and getting revenue something like $40, $45 billion a year.
Along with the rollback in regulations, for-profit schools have also benefited from refined recruitment strategies. They mostly serve students with no other options, and they've become very good at making that sell.
You believe that a real college is interested in you and sees promise in you and can change your life. And this school really cares about me. It's a pretty good pitch. If you start to resist, all of these schools had playbooks on overcoming objections. It's too much time. Well, we have flexible hours. I can't afford it. Financial aid is available. I really don't think I can do it. Don't you want your children to be proud of you? Aren't they ashamed now that you can't put food on the table? It becomes very manipulative. And many of these schools had some variant of something called the pain funnel, where they would poke the pain of the applicant and their shame and leverage that to get them to buy.
For-profit schools target low-income students because they qualify for more federal aid money. And that federal aid goes directly to the schools, not to the students. So the more students they enroll, the more money they rake in. And veterans like Mike are an even bigger prize. In addition to federal loans, they bring in extra GI Bill funding. And these schools can be very aggressive when they try to recruit students.
These schools are really not schools. They're call centers with some kind of a veneer of a school attached to it.
Back in November of last year, I actually put myself on the mailing list for one of these schools. I won't name the school, but it's operated by the same company behind Gibbs, Mike's first school. They called me 46 times. The calls continued for more than 4 months, sometimes multiple in a day. Historically, these schools will do and say just about anything to enroll a student, including lying about job placement opportunities.
So you're treated well, you're taken around, you see some gleaming facilities, and then you're brought into a room, and it's similar to when you're buying a used car. You're told this class is filling up, there's only one or two spots left, and that it's hard to get in. They see the promise in you, and if you sign today, you'll be able to come. And if you don't sign, you might not get in. That's always a lie. They'll take anyone, anytime.
While schools rake in taxpayer dollars, students end up stuck with a bill, oftentimes for the rest of their lives. That was Mike's experience at both Gibbs and the Art Institute, both owned and operated by major players in the for-profit space. When we last heard from Mike, he had decided to withdraw from the New England Institute of Art, operated by a for-profit company called the Art Institutes. Mike withdrew after a professor pointed out that he had taken out enough loans to cover Harvard's tuition. After leaving, Mike found a temp job, ironically as a bill collector at a collections agency. But now that he's not enrolled, he's also no longer under the umbrella of deferment. In general, while a student is still in school, loan payments are deferred. But once you're out, whether or not you've graduated, the bills start coming due.
I remember I got a bill from Sallie Mae. It was like, what, like had to be $200, $300. It was high enough that I was like, that's high, but you know what? I mean, they said it was going to be like that. That's fine, whatever. And I remember I paid it. Later on that month, I got another bill from Sallie Mae. It had to have been between $600 to $800 plus. It was high enough that I was like, wait, this is more than people pay in rent, and I can't afford this.
Mike was confused. So he thought back to those promissory notes he signed.
They would slide the paperwork to you, you know, to fill out like the promissory notes, and they would have you leave the amount blank. And they say, oh, we'll fill that in for you. That was every semester. So you didn't really know what you were signing for, which back then, you know, I thought it was a normal process.
Completely without his knowledge, Mike had signed up not just for federal loans, but for private loans, and a lot of them.
At that point, I had definitely felt played. I just didn't know how to financially handle it. And I remember I disputed and kind of moved on with my life and kind of tried to forget.
Mike refused to pay for the private loans. After all, Gibbs and the Art Institute had completely misrepresented the aid he was signing up for. But as it turned out, he had little choice in the matter.
Eventually it started that they were garnishing me, I don't know if it was 33%, maybe 15%, but it was every single check.
Wage garnishment allows a lender to take money directly from a debtor's paycheck. For the next 2 years, Mike watched as $10,000 was deducted from his earnings.
It felt like a low point because I didn't know what to do. At one point, you're choosing between food and gas to get to work. You know, you're paying rent. And that garnishment doesn't take that stuff into account. They didn't even have to go to court. It was just like a drawing it right out of your paycheck.
Straight out of the Army, Mike, in an honest effort to pursue a career that should have been in reach, was conned by two colleges. The cost of attendance was intentionally hidden and misrepresented. And the further he got from his time as a student, the more clear the situation became.
It had to have been like $100,000 worth of debt somewhere. I didn't know which way was up at the time, and I was feeling so desperate.
And there was no help available to Mike. Legally, the debt was his, and it was something he'd have to carry for what looked like the rest of his life. For the last 20 years, Mike has struggled with not just the financial impact of these loans, but the personal impact too. He was never able to secure a job at Turbine, and he had to find a career completely unrelated to the very expensive education he'd gotten.
I blamed myself. You know, oh, I'm not good enough, and that's why these companies aren't calling me back, or this is why it's Turbine's not calling me back, because I did, over a number of years, try to get their attention.
Throughout all our conversations, Mike kept saying how he should have known something was off, how he should have done more research, how he should have seen the red flags. I suspect some of you had the same thoughts while listening. Oh, I feel bad for Mike, but I'd never fall for that. But before you write this off as the story of someone not doing their due diligence, let's take a step back and consider the bigger picture. Gibbs College and the New England Institute of Art weren't some fly-by-night operation. They were both accredited degree-granting colleges. They met the legal standards to receive federal funding. They had all the hallmarks of a legitimate school. Here's David Halperin again.
Many students enroll in schools in part because the school is accredited and recognized by the Department of Education. The school has a good housekeeping seal from the department. And indeed, many for-profit schools use that fact as part of the pitch. We're accredited just like Harvard. We're accredited just like the University of Idaho. That's an assurance. So the Department of Education itself is complicit in giving the student the sense that that's a good school to attend.
Put yourself in Mike's shoes for a second. You're the first in your family to attend college, and a college presents you with a program that is perfect for your goals. And the icing on the cake is that they have a federal lender to help cover the cost. Honestly, who of us wouldn't jump at that opportunity? Plus, you don't get to see the bill until you're done, so you'll probably stick with it because it feels like a waste to quit. You only get the degree if you stay till the end anyways.
Like, I've seen cartoons describing it really good, where it'd be like a robber holding up a student loan document to sign, and then the bank comes to rob you instead.
Next up on Campus Files, the story of Ashley Pizzuti, a student of another for-profit school.
I enter my recruiter's office, where he is hastily throwing all of his personal items into a box, and he is angry. And he turns to me and he goes, "I am so sorry, these people are liars."
Ashley has fought for years against this industry, working with the White House and legislators from across the country.
We had our press conference and we had 70 other legislators that had signed on to agree that all of the for-profit bad actors should have their loans canceled. We were begging them, like, do anything, please don't throw us to the wolves.
That's next week on Campus Files.
Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast. This episode was written and reported by Ian Mont. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont, Elliot Adler, and me, Margot Gray. Our executive producers and story editors are Maddie Sprunkheiser and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Basil and Andy Jaskowitz. Special thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman, J.D. Crowley, Leah Reese-Dennis, Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Kurt Courtney, Hilary Schuff, Sean Cherry, Laura Berman, and Hilary Van Ornum. Original theme music by James Waterman and Davey Sumner. If you have tips or story ideas, write to us at campusfilespod@gmail.com.